Oh, the beautiful voice of Barbara Streisand brings us into the first portion of our program today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Well, Rosh Hashanah starts on September 6th of this year, followed by Yom Kippur on the 15th. And on the show today, we'll talk about how they are celebrated, the history behind these holy days. Our guest, Deborah Dash Moore. Deborah is the Frederick G.L. Heatwell Professor of History and Professor of Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. She's also the editor-in-chief of the Posen Library. So lots to talk about with her, and I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about these holidays? How does your family maybe celebrate the holidays? Join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Deborah Dash Moore, welcome. Great to have you with us today.
It's lovely to be with you.
Well, let's before we talk about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, let's talk about the Posen Library a bit first. Tell us about the library.
So the Posen Library of Jewish Culture and Civilization is a 10-volume anthology, all in English, translations from many, many different languages, everything I like to say from Amharic to Yiddish. And it is currently 5 volumes are available. Volume 1, which covers the biblical period, and then 4 other volumes in the modern era, starting from 1750. Now, it's published by Yale University Press, but there's also a digital version of the library called posenlibrary.com, and that's available to anyone who wants to register for free, and you have access to all of these selections through the digital format. So it gives you a wonderful overview of Jewish culture and civilization, writings, memoirs, visual material, paintings, photography, just all kinds of stuff is up there.
Yeah. Wow. What an undertaking. It's huge. What's that process been like?
Well, it began as the brainchild of Felix Posen, hence the Posen Library, who was born in Berlin, came to the United States as a kid, grew up here, became very successful in business. And at a certain point, he met some Israelis who were engaged with a more humanistic Judaism. And he had rejected his Orthodox upbringing and realized, my gosh, there's all this other Jewish culture I don't know anything about, right? And so he convened a bunch of people, scholars, Israeli scholars, American scholars, you know, together. And they said, yeah, you know, it would be a good thing to do. I mean, anthologies are things that Jews do a lot of. In some ways, you can think of the Bible as an anthology. Certainly the Passover Haggadah, which you read, is an anthology. And on, Jews constantly anthologize as ways of sort of making sense of their heritage. And what's great about this anthology, of course, is it makes all this material available in English.
Yeah. Wow. So, and so this is a different kind of library from what you might sort of the average library, I guess?
Yeah, it's a different kind of library because you have relatively short selections, 1,000 to 2,000 words if it's from a story or even from a novel. You're not getting the whole thing. You're getting a taste of it. And this is the role of the volume editors had in choosing what to include, which is a challenging choice, and then what section of the selection to include.
And you sit there as the editor-in-chief.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I sit in, and to be honest, I make sure that uncommon voices are included, which means especially voices of women, because in the classical Jewish tradition, we have mostly male voices. even up through the modern period. We think of male intellectuals, rabbis. Women couldn't become rabbis until very recently. And yet women were contributing. They were helping to shape Jewish culture. There's a wonderful example in volume six of a midwife's record, which is a Jewish task, right? Mm-hmm. Of a woman. And she lived in the Netherlands, and she kept records in Hebrew, Yiddish, and Dutch, right? Wow. Of the births. Yes. And at the beginning of her record, she has a prayer, which is a gorgeous prayer that says, you know, may God make sure that my hands, you know, deliver healthy babies. And that's also part of Jewish culture and civilization, right? Even though it's not in a prayer book or anything.
You got me interested right there in that piece. And it sounds like there are going to be really thousands of pieces. How are people using the resource?
Well, if you do go into the posenlibrary.com, right, the digital resource, and let's say you're interested in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, type in the word Kippur, K-I-P-P-U-R, and up will pop a bunch of selections. So you'll have stories, you'll have a selection from a play, you'll have photography, all kinds of material comes up just by typing in that one word, and then you can browse through and sort of see what's there.
Wow, that's fascinating. And here you are, this is not a completed project. This library is not complete.
No, we have another five volumes to go. And we've been publishing them out of order. So the next volume to appear is volume five, which is the early modern period, covers from 1500 to 1750. And then we keep moving back in time, except we do have the biblical material up, which is great, which includes not just material from the Bible, but also extra biblical material. So I'll give you an extra biblical example. There's a section in the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, that talks about you shall not keep your worker's cloak overnight. All right, and okay, that's good. You know, in other words, people interpret it today. You should pay somebody the wages that they're due,
yeah,
if they've done the labor. So in the Posen Library, you also have a letter from a worker who is writing to the governor and said, I did the harvest. I got everything in before the Sabbath. And then this guy comes and he takes my cloak, right? And that's not fair. And so what you get, and the letter goes on to say, I should add, that ask my fellow workers and they will support that I did the labor. So what you get is a sense of the lived reality of the biblical world, and not just the laws that appeared, but, you know, sort of the basis of the meaning of the laws in the context of that era.
Wow. And that's what really brings it all to life in so many ways, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's the kind of thing that biblical scholars know, of course. They know all this extra biblical material, as it's called, because it's not in the Bible. But most of us, and I include myself in that, we don't know this stuff. And it's like, oh, it opens your eyes. Yeah.
Deborah Moore, our guest today from the University of Michigan, where she's the Frederick Heatwell Professor of History. Professor of Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan as well, the editor-in-chief of the Posen Library, and we've been learning a lot about the Posen Library. It just sounds fascinating to me. And again, it's available to you as long as we're talking about it. You can go to Posen, that's P-O-S-E-N, posenlibrary.com, and just see what all is up there. Including, I know, information about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as well. And guess what? They're beginning the end of the beginning and end of the 10 days of repentance, I guess is what we explain how they interact.
Sure. So Rosh Hashanah, which starts in the evening, all Jewish holidays start in the evening of the day before, begins the evening of the 6th. And it is the Jewish New Year holiday. And it's not celebrated like January 1 is celebrated, right? I mean, people don't have big parties and make New Year's resolutions and stuff. But it is celebrated in synagogue. It's a day of reflection about the year that passed, as well as the year to come. And you hope for a sweet year. That's one of the things that people wish for. And so one of the practices with Rosh Hashanah is to have apples and to slice them and dip them in honey. And that symbolizes the hope for a sweet year. And then you get these 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which comes the evening of the 15th. And Yom Kippur is a very different kind of holiday. The 10 days in between are days of repentance and of making amends. So let's say, I said something really nasty to you, Larry. In the past year, which I didn't because I didn't know you. I should, in fact, call you up and say, I'm sorry. I didn't really mean that. And you're supposed to try to correct things in the relations that you have with other people, right? So that when Yom Kippur comes, which is a fast day, it's a 25-hour fast, you are ready to give evidence, as it were, of teshuvah or of repentance, and therefore to hopefully get a kind of clean slate so that you can go on and actually live the new year. So that's the relationship between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Well, it's fascinating. You know, in a way, it's kind of it's something all of us should do at some point. But to have a time set aside to do that as a reminder, and I'll bet in some cases an excuse for somebody to call their sister they haven't spoken with in the last year because they had a fight or something.
Right. That is part of what it's supposed to do. That's correct. For Adam and for a person and the person's relationship to try to help make whole things that have been ruptured in the past year.
Fascinating. Deborah Dashmore, our guest, as we listen to her, I hope you'll join in with your questions as we visit with her about these high holidays of the Jewish religion. It's fascinating to me. I hope it is to you. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Ditter is our engineer, by the way. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Deborah Dashmore, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Deborah Dashmore is the Frederick Heatwell Professor of History and Professor of Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan, also Editor-in-Chief of the Posen Library. So what questions, as we talk with her about the Jewish holidays, what questions do you have about them? Also be interested in wondering how your family may celebrate as well. I wonder if everybody celebrates kind of in the same way or if it's different. I want to ask Deborah about that. But Ron in Madison has a comment or question, so let's go there. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I've been confused for years. Of course, I've been reading modern English translations done by various Christian denominations. You were just explaining that the Jewish New Year is coming up very soon in a few days. When I read the book of Exodus, I believe that's the second one in the Torah, in the English translations, it mentions the Passover before the flight from Egypt toward Israel, Palestine, Sinai, etc. But one sentence in there says, apparently a command from the Almighty to the Jewish people. You shall place this month at the head of your calendar. And so I assume that meant the first day of that lunar month would be the new year on the Jewish calendar, but apparently that's not the case. And has that part of Exodus been extremely distorted from the original way it was written down?
Deborah?
Question. And I didn't give it in my initial description, but yes, the first month happens in the spring with Passover. The Jewish New Year, however, begins on the seventh month. And that, too, you can find in the Torah. It says on the seventh month, we're in the month of Tishrei, you have the Jewish New Year of Rosh Hashanah and the holiday of Yom Kippur. I'm not an expert on calendars, but, you know, the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar that is intercalated with a solar calendar. So let's say, unlike the Muslim calendar, where the holidays, you know, it's just a lunar calendar and they move around a lot, Jewish holidays move, but within a relatively narrow framework, so that you get every 19 years, you have a bunch of leap years, and a leap year has an extra month, the month of Adar. So it keeps the movement relatively constrained. Although American Jews, you know, will say, oh, Rosh Hashanah is early this year, right? By which they mean not that it's not on the right Hebrew date of Tishrei, but they mean on the regular American calendar, it's coming early in September rather than, let's say, late in September, or that's what they describe. So that's sort of a colloquial way of how Americans deal with it. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Ron, for calling. I have to tell a little story on our University of Wisconsin campus, where I'm also a professor there. And I think when the semester was designed and set up and the dates were, frankly, not where, you know, my class, the first class I teach this term starts on the 8th of September. Right. And so there were many apologies, certainly from the chancellor and others. And we've sort of all of us who teach have done a little, made some changes to sort of reflect the what we're assigning for work and that sort of thing.
Yeah, New Year's schedule usually disrupts, especially public school practice, in the sense that where you have large numbers of Jews living, as in New York City, for example, for really up until 1960, you would have large numbers of children who wouldn't attend on the Jewish holidays, right? And the school went on. So much so that at one point, demographers had what they called the Yom Kippur method of estimating Jewish population, where they would take the number of absences from the New York City public schools, right? Compare them to the regular schedule of how many students there were, postulate a certain family size, right, for Jews, and thus come up with a Jewish population. They don't use that method anymore, but that was a method, yeah.
Oh, and Wisconsin, just as an aside, has a fairly large Jewish student population. Part of that goes back to many, many, many years back when Jewish students were denied the opportunity in many of the Eastern universities, and we were happy, and probably Michigan too.
Yeah.
Accept them, and of course that's contributed over time. Those alums have children and so forth, and so that's how that works. Anyway, I always thought that was a great story. What do families do at home during Rosh Hashanah, for example?
So Rosh Hashanah, usually there's a festive meal in the evening before the holiday that families gather. There are certain foods that are traditional depending upon your background. So if you're an Ashkenazi Jewish background, which means if you your family comes from Europe, especially Eastern Europe, but also Central Europe is true. And most American Jews, something around 80% of them trace their background to Ashkenazi Jewish traditions. You'll have foods like gefilte fish and chicken soup, as well as other kinds of special foods. One of the things that you can do on the holiday that families do at home is, because it's a new year, you get a chance to say a special blessing, which is called a Shehechiyanu, which is a blessing that thanks God for bringing one in health to actually experience this moment. And you can say that blessing over all kinds of fruits that you haven't yet eaten because it's the new year. So you can say it over pomegranates. That's a popular choice because it appears in the fall. And it's sort of fun to be saying these Shehechiyanu blessings that recognize the specialness of the moment. So that's one thing that families do, yeah.
I was thinking about, you know, as we were talking about how the dates change, I was thinking about Christian Easter, for example.
Yep.
Easter, those dates change every single year, although they kind of rotate within a fairly narrow, maybe a month period.
Right. And usually Easter and Passover are pretty close, right? Because of their historic connections. Yeah.
You know, these are solemn days of reflection, as I see it anyway. I am sure you see it that way as well. Are there other celebratory events that surround this that we...
Well, so these are holidays, holy days, where the main focus is actually on the synagogue. And you began with the Avinu Malkeinu, you know, our father, our king, that Barbara Streisand was singing. That is one of the prayers that is sung on Yom Kippur and is asking for forgiveness for sins. It's special. There is a special liturgy for the holy days. Yom Kippur is a day of fasting that many Jews will spend almost completely in the synagogue itself. Right? And there are these different structured services that take you through the synagogue. It's also a time of remembrance. There's a memorial service called Yizkor, so a remembrance of those who have died, and it brings them back, as it were, into consciousness again at this moment, a serious time of reflection. So it's not just you and your family members who may be with you, but also, you know, the many family members who have lived in the past, and they're remembered. As well as certain historic memories there. There's a section of the service that attempts to sort of recapitulate what happened on the Temple Mount when there was a temple standing on in Jerusalem. And there's a service about that. And then there are some very powerful selections that are read during these high holy days. So one of them, for example, is the selection of what is called the Akedah, or the sacrifice of Isaac, right? So that story of father, son, which is a really difficult story.
Yeah. It's a difficult story, actually, to read as well. having read it a number of times myself, if I'm not mistaken, Jewish law prohibits working or going to school or on these holidays. And I can't imagine that's easy if with most, you know, because it's most businesses and schools aren't closed.
Right. It's one of those times for American Jews where their difference is very visible, right? Because Jews who have businesses usually close them. Not all, of course. Not every Jew goes to synagogue, but very often Jews will nonetheless refrain from work. They may go for a walk in the park. And find other ways of marking the holy day. Not every Jew abstains from eating, right? Fasting on Yom Kippur. But these are days of serious reflection and are meant to disrupt the ordinary path of life. Yom Kippur is often called a Sabbath of Sabbaths, which is an emphasis on how much rest and how much you're not supposed to be doing your normal activities.
You know, and I think about Christianity, I think about all of the, Lutheran, Methodist, name one. And so there's a broad range within Christianity itself of beliefs, and it sounds like I'm sure it is true with the Jewish.
Oh yes, there's a very broad range among Jews, from Jews who consider themselves non-religious and may choose to mark the holy days just as a political gesture, right? Say, okay, these are important for fellow Jews. I'm not going to synagogue, but I'm going to, not go to my regular activity work, all the way through reform, conservative, to many different forms, actually, of orthodoxy, where the stringencies of what to do are very apparent in how the holy day is observed. There's one custom which I didn't mention, which might be of interest to your viewers, but it developed relatively late in Jewish history, and it's called Tashlich. It's a custom of going to a flowing body of water and taking breadcrumbs, which you put in your pocket, and you then toss the breadcrumbs that symbolize sort of the sins of the past into the flowing water, and they get carried away. And there's a short prayer service that is said then. And that's,
what a lovely idea.
It's probably a practice that may have been initiated from Jewish-Christian contact in Europe, actually.
Yeah. Oh, well, I was just wondering, who thought that up? How do these situations, develop? And it's always surprising to me. And it's always kind of fun to learn or at least speculate.
So that scholars speculate that may have been a practice picked up initially by women, because women, although they certainly were present in the synagogue, were silent in the synagogue, right? They did not conduct the services at all, and they sat separately from the men, and this was something that the women could do outside of the synagogue. There's another practice before Yom Kippur of taking, called slugging kaporos, where you take a chicken that you're going to kill and eat, and you wave it over the heads of the various family members, and again, requesting that the sins of the family members go onto the chicken, and then the chicken is slaughtered. Right? So Most American Jews don't do that anymore, but it is still done. I mean, there used to be a lot of live chicken markets where Jews lived, right? And in general, Jews bought their chickens freshly slaughtered. They didn't have them frozen, right? In the 20th century,
yeah.
The frozen chickens are a relatively recent development.
I want to go back. You mentioned women just a couple of seconds ago, and I wonder about the roles of men and women. Roles are there something differences that in terms of their roles during this time?
Well, I think in the United States today, for the most part, the differences have become more muted of the roles. I would say that usually women are the ones who prepare the meals still. The meal for Rosh Hashanah is a big meal. The break fast at the end of Yom Kippur is also, prepared ahead of time. So it's like a large break fast. And the meal preceding the fast is an important meal because you want to be fortified for the 25-hour fast that awaits you. So that, to best of my knowledge, is still something that women tend to do rather than men. Going to synagogue, women certainly in Reform and conservative congregations, as well as Orthodox ones, do go to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Those are, again, activities that everybody participates in. The difference is that if you go to most Orthodox congregations, the women will not be involved in leading the services or in reading from the Torah. I mean, there are some egalitarian Orthodox services which will allow it. Whereas in the conservative and Reform and Reconstructionist and other Jewish groups, women are doing everything that men do that way.
Yeah. What are...
Can I add one other thing? Because I think, while we're talking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, when Yom Kippur ends, you're supposed to go out and bang the first nail into a sukkah, which is a little hut, because a couple of days later comes the holiday of Sukkot, which is the harvest holiday. So it's a big change of mood, and Sukkot is one of the sources for the American Thanksgiving.
Right? Oh.
This fall harvest holiday. So in some ways, these fall holidays with Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, they don't really end until you have Sukkot and the harvest. Right? They're knit together.
Yeah. What's probably or maybe what are a couple of the biggest misconceptions I think that non-Jews have when they think about Judaism?
That's a very difficult question. I think that when non-Jews think about Judaism, what's difficult is to disentangle the cultural and civilization pieces of Judaism from the commanded parts of Judaism, so that there are commandments, there are mitzvot, as they're called, but there's also minhag or cultural practices that don't have the same religious force, as the commanded pieces, but are often very much a part of being Jewish. Sending New Year's cards on Rosh Hashanah is it's not commanded. It became a practice that Jews started to do a century or so ago. What I described as the, Shlokim Kippuris, it's not commanded. It's a practice. And I think it's really difficult to recognize, because like Christianity, Judaism is a lived civilization.
Yeah.
It has all of these other elements in it. It's not just about belief. It's not just about the synagogue. It's about all of these other aspects. And I think that's really difficult.
Yeah. And Randall in Sun Prairie has a question that kind of relates to what you were just talking about, I think. Randall, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I was just wanting to get your guests' thoughts on the fact that, you know, Judaism was the forerunner of Christianity, and why so many Jews failed to accept Jesus as the foretold Messiah.
All right.
Okay. So that's one of the big differences, especially from the point of view of Christianity, because Jesus occupies for Christians a critical, vital role in shaping Christianity. And for Jews, Jesus' prophecies were really valuable. In fact, some of them are going to be included in Volume 2 in the Posen Library of Jewish Culture and Civilization, seen through a Jewish perspective, but they don't have the centrality that they do for Christians. And that was true centuries ago, and it's been true across those many centuries. There's there have been, I'm not, you know, there's an expression in Hebrew called lahavdil, which is to say I'm not really comparing. But Jews have also faced others who have made messianic claims, right, which they have rejected, right? And probably the most recent of the Jewish messianic claims circulate around the late Chabad rabbi of blessed memory, Menachem Schneerson. There are people who see him as the forerunner of Messiah. So the Messiah idea remains around, but it has not ever gotten fixated and connected to the single Messiah of Jesus.
And on that note, we are out of time. Deborah, I want to go back and just mention the Posen Library again. People could, I'm actually going to take another look too. PosenLibrary.com is just going to be a wonderful resource. And I want to thank you so much for your work with the library, but also for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure, Deborah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Deborah Dashmore, the Frederick Heatwell Professor of History, Professor of Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan, and Editor-in-Chief of the Posen Library. What an interesting person, and a nice person, too. I was really happy to have a chance to talk with her today. I learned some things, and I bet you did as well. It's been, I hope you did, anyway. It's been a lot of fun. And I think you're going to learn a little bit from our next guest coming up. Bassam Shakashiri joins us to talk science. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Avinu Malkeinu, Chadesh Alam.